Welcome to the Business of Sustainability podcast from Future Plus. If you're passionate about building a more sustainable future and curious about the business models making it possible, you're in the right place.
In each episode, we dive into the world of sustainable business, talking to founders, CEOs, and industry pioneers who are redefining success with people and the environment in mind. This isn't just another business podcast. At Future Plus, we're redefining ESG, environmental, social, and governance by bringing your data-driven insights and future-focused actions that make a real impact.
From breakthrough technologies to bold new policies, Future Plus explores the strategies, challenges, and innovations driving the global shift towards sustainability. So whether you're a business leader, investor, or sustainability enthusiast, join us to stay ahead of the curve.
So hit subscribe and join us as we explore how data and action are reshaping the business world one episode at a time. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Mike Penrose. Thank you for joining us today. I'm delighted to say we're joined by Mark Rushmore, co-founder and COO of Suri, a brand that's not only transforming one of the most traditional industries in the world, but also instilling sustainability at its core.
So Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, it would be great to get a little bit of background. Who are you? What do you do? Why do you do it? And what does it look like?
Wow. I mean, we could just cover that.
We could do that for the next 20 minutes.
Like, the big question. Like,
Who are you?
We didn't tell you this was an existential
podcast. Like, wow, you know, that's
and we're
big
not
guys.
Leaving until we found the answer.
Well, I'm glad. I'd love to know myself. Who am I? Well, maybe I could give a bit of a background. So, firstly, I'm the father of two children who are 5 and 3 and the proud husband of a wife called Caroline. I think beyond that, I'm, you know, the son of my parents, the brother of my brother and sister. So I think first and foremost, that's who I am. But in terms of business-wise, I started my career at Procter & Gamble, working in a variety of sales and strategy roles, ultimately managing Pringles when it was acquired by Kellogg's. I helped transition that company across. And then, do you want the longer or the shorter version of this answer?
Whichever you feel most comfortable with.
Well, around that time, unfortunately, a friend from university committed suicide, and I always thought he was a very friendly, happy person. It wasn't a close friend, but still, nonetheless, I thought, oh gosh, that's, you know, it's obviously awful. But also sort of started making me think about, you know, actually, what do I want to do in my life? And, you know, what do I want, you know, what experiences are important and what's important? And I realized maybe there was more to life than just what I was doing. So I wrote a list of all the things I wanted to do, you know, in my life. And I was like, why don't I try and just do them now rather than waiting until I retire? And so I did a ski instructor course in Canada and learned how to teach children to ski. Then I cycled. Unsupported from Canada to Mexico. Then I won a digital media competition to sail around the world as part of the Clipper Around the World Yacht Race. But then when I was training for that, I got ill and had an operation. I thought, actually, you know what? I prefer like the sailing in the summer, like where you sort of...
The sensible version.
Like eat biscuits and like go for a
swim. Gin and tonics.
Yeah. And I actually don't like transatlantic crossings in the winter. But I also really wanted to always set up a company and I didn't really know how you go about it. I just knew I wanted to do it, but I didn't know how. So stupidly, I sort of sat down and wrote a list of companies that I admired and would love to own. So I wrote this list and I was like, oh, I'd love to own Google. I'd love to own Facebook. Soho House looks pretty cool. But one of the other companies was an experiential marketing agency who I'd worked with when I was at P&G. And I always thought they seemed like really cool guys. I think if I was to do that exercise again, hands on heart, I would have you guys on that list. I think you guys are doing a phenomenal job.
Thank you very much.
Like
But like, you know, I think someone setting out, you know, seeing, you know, what you're doing and how you're doing it is something I truly admire and you know, I'd be proud to have a company like yours. But anyway, you weren't around at that time. So I wrote an email to all those companies, anyone I knew. Facebook didn't respond. Google also her house neither. But the experiential marketing agency did and said, in front of you should email us. We actually want someone to set up an office as a partner. Would you like to do that? And so a lot of crazy stories later, but I set that up. 5 years later, I sold that company. And during that time, I learned a lot, mainly from like failing badly on multiple occasions. But I also won Oral-B as a client. And I learned lots about the oral care industry, And then I was randomly invited to an event in Cannes, in the south of France, and bumped into, like literally just bumped into at a trade fair, the CMO of Unilever, this guy called Keith Weed. And he was like, we got chatting and he said, oh, every year I host this event for CEOs and CMOs on an island off the coast of Cannes. And someone just dropped out. Like, do you want to come along?
That's a very serendipitous bumping into.
I was like, yeah, like, would I, of course. And so I was like in my like mid 20s running the agency. And you know, I got onto a speedboat to go to this event, and sat beside me were some titans of the marketing industry, one of whom I wanted to sell my company to, and sort of in an inadvertent way did. But sat beside him was this young guy, and so when we got to the island, we were about 20 or 30 years younger than everyone else. And so I sort of went over to this young guy. I was like, yeah, you know, what's your story? And he was working as a right hand man to the founder of WPP, and I said, well, how did you get that job? And it turned out he used to work at Procter & Gamble. This is a long answer, isn't it? I'm sorry about this.
It's good. It's a very good
answer.
But,
you know, and we bonded over the fact that, you know, I was in sales and strategy. He was in finance and marketing and based in Geneva. I was based in the UK. And he said, I was like, wow, you know, what a career you've had. Amazing. Mainly because I want to, you know, learn more about how to sell my company to his boss. But also because, you know, we had that shared interest. And he said, you know what, Mark, I'm doing this, but I really envy what you're doing in setting up this business, because I've had this idea. You know, what's your idea, Keith? And he said, well, you know, when I sold, you know, millions and millions of units of Gillette, and when you were selling Pringles, did you ever think about like the impact that it was having, like all this plastic? And I was like, yeah, definitely. Because, you know, P&G sells, you know, billions and billions of items. And he was just saying, you know, although, you know, obviously they want to make, you know, less of an impact, just the scale and size of it makes it very difficult. And Keith's also probably like one of the top 1,000 Apple fanboys. Like, he really, really loves Apple. And from the beginning, he knows every advert they ever produced, who did it, you know, every product, every engineer. Like, he really loves it. And he was like, you know, and Apple really redefined what like customer experience meant, whether that's the unpackaging, the unboxing, the, you know, the way it feels in store, the advertising, the customer service, the product itself, you know, the how it, you know, the weight in your hand. And he said, literally in our first meeting, you know, I think if you could create a consumer brand that addresses some of the significant sustainability issues within the category and combine it with really great user experience, you could create a world leading product. And I was like, wow, what a insight and what a vision. Like, that's, yeah, I completely agree. So we became friends, and then years later, I moved on and sold the company, and he'd worked for some venture capital firms. He came back and said, look, you know, I've done more research. Every year, over 4 billion brushes get thrown away and end up in landfill and oceans. Virtually every single toothbrush you've ever used still exists. I think we can do something better that not only champions like a more sustainable electric toothbrush, but also creates like a better user experience. And that is who I am.
That's quite a remarkable story, and you know, incredibly sort of
something
sad.
Half of it, to be honest.
Quite, you know, quite a sad starting point of where you got to, but actually what that encouraged you to do and where to go and sort of all of those things. That's a huge impact on you personally that you've clearly brought into the brand. You're doing it, so thank you. And I don't know if I'd realised that you'd done the clip around the world yacht race.
So I didn't end up doing it. So in the end, I came runner-up, and I was meant to sail from Qingdao to San Francisco.
Yep.
on the leg across the Pacific. But ultimately, I just came to this realization. It was, I think, a lot of business is around ego. And I am, like any other person, you know, partly driven by ego, and probably more when I was younger. And when it came down to it, I realized, do I want to just tell people I sailed across the ocean? Or would I actually really truly enjoy it and get value from it? Or could there be a better way of spending that time and money? Although it actually was subsidized because of the competition. And yeah, I realized I was doing it more probably for my ego. And ultimately, as nice it would be to say to someone, I sailed across an ocean, I'd equally like to just set up a company.
We've got a shortcut for you. So the last one of the last podcasts we did is with Laura, who's the managing director of Clipper Around the World Yacht Race, who is one of our clients.
Nice.
So all you need to do now is listen to the podcast and you're good to
go. Yeah.
And just to you know, for the audience, for the small world that we live in, Paul used to work for the Clipper Around the World Yacht Race.
No
as
way.
Did I.
So this gets even weirder. When I turned up for training, one of my university friends was a skipper the year that I was meant to go, Oliver Cotterill. Oh, it was the Henry Lloyd Challenge year. I mean, we can go into it. I think
it's
I was robbed
it's a small
in the final,
world.
But,
it's the 7 degrees of separation, yeah. I think, is about three when it comes to the obvious. But anyway, you don't have to do it. You can listen to the podcast. But yeah. Mike, I will hand over to you for proper questions rather than catch-ups.
But again, the number of times we have this 7 degrees of separation on podcasts where we've met before, haven't we? It is a very small world. But one of the things you said in your introduction, I think, really for me resonates, and it's a problem we've got to address in the sustainability industry, is... people either perceive it as being expensive, or to be honest, the quality you tend to get when things are sustainable is much poorer than the quality you would get if you bought a non-sustainable product. And one of the things I love about the Suri products, you know, I use them, is they do have that the feel of the box, the charger, the UV lights, the way it's put together. It feels like an Apple product, like the Apple of toothbrushes, etc. You don't feel as though you're compromising on quality. And I think that's such an important thing in terms of differentiating a sustainable product from a non-sustainable one, is you've got to have the quality there alongside the purpose and the impact that it can have. But you know, achieving that and building that sustainable and also quality ethos into a business is not an easy thing to do. You know, it's what we help people with, and they struggle with it all the time. How have you done that at Suri?
Well, firstly, thank you. You know, I think that's a very kind compliment, and actually probably one of my happiest moments maybe of all time was when we got an email from Johnny Ive, who was, you know, the chief product officer at Apple, saying that he thought they were fabulous and congratulations. That was a real, like, Eve and I were giggling next to our wives, like, separately, like on the phone to each other. And it was a real nice moment, because I think you said, you know, you don't want to feel like you're compromising on performance. Like with Suri, you absolutely do not compromise on performance. So we have three core tenants to the brand. They are performance, design, and sustainability. And we don't, like, you know, we don't compromise where possible on any of those three. We're constantly looking to have the best performance possible, you know, the best design, and that's not just how it looks, but it's, you know, the functionality, like a 40-day battery life or a UV light in the case, as also to be as sustainable as possible. Are we perfect on all three? No. Are we constantly striving to improve on all three? Absolutely. So how we did it is we sort of, quite frankly, I don't think consumers want to compromise on performance first and foremost. Do you know what I mean? There's no point in having a good looking toothbrush that's more sustainable, that doesn't clean your teeth. It has to deliver as good or better performance for its primary purpose. And I think maybe sustainability 1.0, whatever you want to call it, was, you know, you accepted that the quality was going to be lower, and that sort of perhaps gave, like, the, you know, people a bad sort of impression of what it meant, or it would be really expensive. I think for us, that wasn't, there was never a sort of a part of our thinking process. Now we have a sort of bit of luck on our side, in as much as if you design it from the beginning with sustainability in mind, you can make decisions earlier versus having to retrofit them, which I think gives us the possibility to sort of really think about performance. But for us, it has to first and foremost deliver a great performance. We work with Professor Damien Walmsley, who you probably are familiar with, is the co-author of the leading academic research, the Cochrane Review into the Efficacy of Electric Brushes, former scientific advisor to British Dental Association, an all-round legend. And, you know, working with him and then doing our clinical studies at Salus Research, who've done most of the clinical trials of leading electric toothbrushes over the last sort of couple of decades, has helped us to clinically prove that we have really high performance. Because ultimately, like, you know, that plus how it feels in, you know, in your hand is going to drive, you know, a large part of how much a consumer wants to engage and recommend a product. And then we've made it as sustainable as possible. Now, for some people, that's the number one reason they buy it, and that's great. But for a lot of people, they're not actually that bothered. the analogy I use, which is maybe a crude one, and I would love some feedback from you, whether you should say, Mark, never say this on any podcast or interview ever again, right? But when I was a child, I didn't love carrots. But my mum would sort of mix them into my mashed potato. So I would be getting like the nutrients. I didn't taste it or whatever. And like that way it was sort of sneaking in, you know, the nutrients. To a certain extent, we feel like, you know, if we just make the best quality electric toothbrush that people love to own and love to use, they don't care about sustainability, but, you know, it's half the size, so it uses less materials, you know, use plant-based renewable materials. We have no plastic in the packaging. The packaging's sort of smaller in size. We offer free recycling where available. Then actually, you know, we're sort of not sneaking sustainability in, but sort of helping consumers make a better choice, even if that's not their primary reason.
I think it just linking to that as well, another aspect, remember we discussed previously that is so essential is repairability as well. And, you know, having things that can be, have a longer lifespan. And we work with a lot of brands that, you know, inherently some of their materials will never be sustainable. So take, you know, performance clothing, you know, for cold weathers and things like that. You can't have sustainable materials within that, but you can make it really good and make it last longer and make it repairable. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, the bamboo stuff that doesn't work very well and isn't very nice, but is 100% recyclable. It can be something that can last a lot longer, can be repaired, where all the consumable bits are recyclable. And it's just as valid, and you get that performance, as you said, and there is nothing wrong with building something that people will like and want to use and cherish and love and that looks beautiful, and then submarining in all the sustainability things because the same objective is being achieved.
Totally, and I think, you know, we're far from perfect, you know, and, you know, Surrey electric toothbrushes are not going to solve climate change or anything. But I think there is something to consider just in the ethos of trying to make something, you know, as sustainable as possible, and to not sort of think like it's a one and done, but like, you know, is there something we can do better? Like, how can we improve this constantly? And I think if you can start and finish your day by brushing your teeth with a product that's been highly considered and, you know, we've put the thought into how can we make it as sustainable as possible, then it's like a nice way to, you know, bring that habit of, you know, what little things can we do to improve, you know, constantly? And if, you know, if in some small way we could all do that, then maybe we could make a larger impact. Obviously, it's a bigger challenge ahead, but, you know, like it feels like a worthwhile way to spend your time and effort.
But I think there's a bigger impact there of you have made something that's sustainable, that is covetable and cool. It looks good. It you know, I mean, but it, even, you know, your
marketing.
Wait till
marketing, you see the new one. Like,
that sounds very exciting. I'm already excited by the new colour schemes that you've, But your marketing is, you know, you can tell that it's a sustainable toothbrush and it's got that behind it. But you've made something that is covetable that people want to have, you know, if you're going to have something on display, I would rather have that. And I think that is a really interesting way because it has a greater impact. So you can have something that's sustainable and cool. And it's moving it on to the next step. And I think, you know, we have lots of conversations where I genuinely believe that people try to find, they will pay for a solution for something. And if they want a solution of something that's covetable, cool, or sustainable, whatever the reason is, it doesn't matter what door they knock. If you can make it, as you say, sustainable with all the improvements that you will do over the period of time, that can only be a benefit. You don't need them to have to buy into the sustainability
exactly.
as a first stage.
So we have this perspective. We may be wrong. We may be right. Let's see. But I suspect strongly in 30 years' time or 40 years' time, like every brand will be much more sustainably thought through, right? At that point, it's not a differentiator. Do you know what I mean? You won't be able to, oh, but, you know, we're sustainable, because every brand will be like that. It's just like an obvious, you know, that should be woven into how we design and manufacture things. And you can see, like, the tide is shifting. And so we don't, you know, I think for a long-term strategy, saying like, you know, you're the sustainable one actually is sort of, it's going to be like, you know, saying like you're a product. It's not a differentiator.
You've got to build everything else in as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, and understanding the consumer, because actually, you know, I think I haven't aligned this with my co-founder, but I just think if you're really customer obsessed and customer focused, and you think about what does your consumer want, what do they think, what do they feel, you know, what one do they want people to see in the bathroom when they come to the house, what does it say about you, you know, like you've got to think about, you know, what matters to people, plus then also, like, you know, guide a little bit in terms of like, okay, hey, how can we put this in? I think starting with that, I think you can have a bigger impact by truly understanding the needs of others. And ultimately, the customer is my boss. Like, we want to deliver for our customer and make sure we do the best by our customer while bringing in, you know, additional elements that we think, you know, will sort of help them in the future, whether that's sustainability or design or performance.
I think the point you made there about it just becoming a natural part of the business process and a consumer product process, it's, you know, it's learning from history. If you look back at some of the biggest social developments that have ever happened, you know, availability of healthcare, education, a lot of them were actually not government initiatives to begin with. They were driven by people like the Rowntrees or the Lever brothers, etc., who realized that, you know, around the Industrial Revolution, that, you know, agrarian workers who drop dead at 30 from tuberculosis aren't very productive when it comes to more industrialized processes and machines. So they created the Rowntree villages and things like that. They gave their workers healthcare. They gave them the Quakers, exactly.
Oh my goodness. I went deep into Quakers recently. Like, I was in Birmingham, did the tour around Cadbury's, and like, the, you know, the Quakers, like, if you look at the sort of outsized impact they've had on, you know, business, but also like social, I mean, there's some other stuff I'm not so sure about, but like, but you know, it's leading with, hey, this feels like the right thing to do for people.
But it makes sense from a business perspective.
It makes sense from a business perspective, but also, you know, giving people more rights, you know, caring about people, sort of feel like quite long-term right things to do. And I think we're driven by that as well. Like, you know, what is right for our consumers? Like, do you want to have a product that feels nice, that does a great job, clean your teeth, is a bit better? And I think so long as, you know, we're not Quakers, but you know, it feels like the right thing to do, and that's what we're trying, at least.
Yeah, and it's, you know, if it makes absolute business sense, this is where we agree that we've actually found with a lot of businesses we're stopping talking about sustainability as the first thing. We start talking about efficiency, we start talking about cost savings, reduction, you know, we'll reduce your waste, we'll reduce your energy, we'll look at it from a business perspective. And people, a bit like the design point you were saying, people pay attention to that. It's actually doing exactly the same thing. It is reducing you know, wastes, emissions, and etc., but it's also positioned as a good business thing. You've incorporated a lot of individual little changes, like some of the ones I've got written down: cast up bean oil bristles, cornstarch brush heads, the fact they're using steel and aluminium, which is either repairable or recyclable, etc., and then incorporating them into your design choices. What are some of the challenges you've had in terms of, exactly as you said, finding the ideal solution that achieves the design that you want and that sustainable underpinning, which is, as you said, integral to your brand?
Yeah, I mean, you run a business, basically just everything is a challenge.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, what are the challenges? Like, just existing.
Yes.
Who am I?
Yes. No. Money, people,
things. Yeah, just like
the
life.
The best version of an entrepreneur I ever heard was you just use a different precipice to see how far you can lean over.
Yeah.
Each day.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of, you know, so there's been a lot of challenges. I think credit to Guive. He is, you know, that man does not take no for an answer. Even sometimes when maybe he, like, I remember him arguing with an embassy around a visa, telling them that their computer system was wrong, not his application, like for a good 10 minutes. I was like, maybe we should just, you know, leave it there. But anyway, I think where it does work is, you know, we went to a couple of dozen factories saying, you know, we want to use these materials, because Guive had come across some research and found other companies who had managed to use materials in a similar vein, but not in our industry. And, you know, so many of them said it's not possible for this reason, or we'd want to test it. Generally, factories work on models of efficiency. And so, you know, going with something new that requires different materials and so on, it's sort of not that interesting, especially when you have no volume. I'm less stubborn, maybe. So I was a bit like, well, maybe, you know, is this possible? Maybe it's not. And I think it's pretty natural to think that after like your 20th rejection, But fortunately, he was like, no, absolutely is. And sure enough, we found someone who went through the process of testing and iterating, and eventually we're like, okay, yes, this material is now meeting all the requirements that we need. And so, yeah, so I think there is a I don't know, an innate quality in someone like Eve where you sort of keep going even in the face of rejection. I mean, like, fundraising is another one. It's like people like, nature. Oh, you guys, you know, you found it so easy. We haven't found it easy. Like, we got rejected by like 98% of people. Fortunately, I learned from dating rejection very early in my life and, you know, just kept going. Eventually, you know, Caroline agreed to marry me and just took the same approach to fundraising. You only need, you know, one or two people. So,
yeah, it's a good lesson.
Sorry, that's not the same approach with my wife. It's not one or two.
just one or two. Is that a conversation?
Yeah, different, but the analogy, you get the...
Two investors, one wife.
Yeah. Exactly. Not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I think there's something to be said as well about that, about efficiency, and it's a conversation that we have frequently, is there is a lot to be said about beauty being built into things as well. And I think sometimes there's a long-term resilience about making something or considering the beauty of it over a period of time. And I'm using the word beauty in a sort of expanded sense. That part, again, going back to the look and the feel and the weight of the product, gives it a resilience or a long-termism that maybe making something simple or easy or efficient doesn't.
And I don't know if you can combine the two, though. That, you know, that's the joy. It's like, if you can make something beautiful but also great value,
yeah, absolutely.
Simple but I think beauty really, have you ever heard about is it like the beauty tax? Like, better looking people get better jobs, are paid more, or all this kind of stuff. Like it or not, like it's a real thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, link to that, as Alex knows, I was going. I think if you look at the initial price, then that's the fallacy as well. You know, there are certain things that I, so the shoes I'm wearing at the moment, there's a particular brand of shoe I absolutely love. And people go, how can you justify spending £400 on a pair of shoes? I go, because they last 15 years. So I'm not spending £400 on a pair of shoe. I'm spending, 28, 30 quid a year on a pair of shoes that look nicer than any of the £100 shoes that you're buying that will wear out in 6 months or 1 year.
£400, really?
Yeah.
Let's see them.
But they are...
I mean, they are nice.
These particular ones are 5 years old. So,
okay, yeah.
So...
So, the toothbrush industry is not the most obvious one to go into. Massive legacy industry.
I disagree. I think it's the most obvious one. How many people do you know who brush their teeth?
Well, that's very good. But not the most obvious to go into with the same level of innovation that you did, because there hasn't been any for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think we, in some ways, it's actually really obvious, right? Yeah. So, like, but... it's the non-obvious, obvious things, which are the sort of the big problems, which you know, can help you create a great business. So, I think now it looks obvious, but it probably wasn't at the time. But you know, everyone brushes their teeth. Yep. You know, at least 50% of people.
Or at least you hope they do.
Developed markets, you know, use an electric brush, and that's growing because they're much more effective in cleaning your teeth versus manual brushes. And yet, when we looked into it, it's like, you know, well, I'll ask you two, like, did you ever use the Bluetooth feature on your last electric toothbrush?
No.
Right? Yeah. Do you ever have that gunk that you formed on the bottom?
Yeah,
that's
really
nasty. Everyone hates that. Did you take it traveling with you?
No.
No, because, you know, you don't want to carry this, like, massive case.
Massive.
Do you want to take this
charger
that only works with your electric brush going through the airport? And so when we started asking people, they were like, yeah, I don't like that. Oh, I don't use that feature. And I was like, okay, well, what would you like? I was like, well, you know, I'd love a long-lasting battery. I'd love it if it didn't have that gunk that's on the bottom. I'd love it if, you know, it was light, quiet, and I could travel with it. So I'm like, okay, well, what if we could combine some of these consumer insights? Like, we didn't come up, like, we just asked people, what would you like? And we listened to them, and they told us what they'd like, and we just thought, okay, why don't we make a product for these people? And then fortunately, you know, when we started sharing, like, hey, this is what we learned and this is what we built, people were like, yeah, like, I brush my teeth. I want a long-lasting battery and one that's light and feels good and makes a sort of a more positive impact. So, yeah, we've been very lucky that a lot of people feel the same way.
When we first met you quite a few years ago now, one of the...
I remember the first moment we met.
I remember the first moment we met as well. Yeah. And one of the things, I think one of the opening lines was, we've been breaking toothbrushes. was your opening line, and we can explain a bit more about that. But it would be great to understand why you came in and told us that and for people to understand. But my question around it is, if there are founders or entrepreneurs coming into different legacy industries, what would your advice be for them to do? Because for you, you broke toothbrushes as your sort of as your opening gambit when we before Suri was a product, and that was the first conversation. But for people coming into those legacy industries, what is it that you needed to do? What would you advise them to do to really understand where they're going with it?
I'm not sure I'd listen to any advice from me for a start. I think we've had a lot of luck, and so I'd love to say it's maybe listen to Yves, he's a total genius. But I think, to the broken toothbrushes, in order to understand, about our competitors, we're like, okay, well, let's just take this brush apart and oh no, it's welded shut. There's 6 to 8 different types of plastic that can't be recycled. How can we get rid of, how can we remove the lithium battery? Because electric waste only accounts for less than 2% of landfill, but it will often account for about 70% of the toxicity found in landfill. So it's not just electric toothbrushes, it's TVs and laptops and so on. But, for us, it was be able to remove the lithium battery component and ensure that's recycled responsibly is a core component if you're going to recycle and reuse components. But it's incredibly difficult, to take apart, you can use a hammer, you can use this, drill. So we've done that with, we know the structure of, hundreds of different brands, of different SKUs, essentially. So my advice to others, I guess, would be to do research, to ask the consumer, what do you like, what don't you like, to understand, is there really a problem or not? Because if there isn't, then maybe, there isn't an opportunity. And then to really understand, who are the competitors, how do they design their products? How do they engineer them and so on? And we sort of grounded everything in really thorough research. And I totally credit P&G for giving us that training to sort of look at the consumer, look at the market share, look at the competitive products, and to do that process. That would probably be my advice. But I feel like that's the most generic advice that you probably get taught in primary school.
No, not at all. I think that research. There are so many things, and you've alluded to it throughout this conversation, where I think we all look at products and are frustrated with them, but somehow that problem's fault still keeps being built into the products
we
use.
You just tolerate it.
You put up with it, rather than somebody actually going, hang on a minute, the emperor is naked. I know because I can see it. This is a thing that we need to incorporate more and actually listen to consumers a little bit more.
It's like Pret, right? Yeah. I love Pret. Go to Pret all the time. And all they did was they were like, do you love the sandwiches you're buying at lunchtime? People were like, No.
I don't like
Why
it.
Not? I don't know. They just taste processed and not that fresh. If we made a fresh sandwich.
Would you buy it?
Would you buy it? Yeah. And it tasted great. Yeah. It was great value and it was near to your office. Boom. Absolutely. Take my money, Brett.
So you've alluded to, you were saying you wait until see the new one, and you said about the new colours. What's, just to sort of round off, what's the next 5 years hold for Suri? What's the future for you?
5 years.
Or 5 minutes.
Dude, next 5 days.
Yeah.
But jokes aside, wouldn't it be cool to build a range of products based on, high quality, delivering on performance, design, and sustainability, so much so that, you could go anywhere in the world and consumers would say, oh, I know that. I love that brand because I can rely on it. It's great. It does a great job, and I feel aligned to the values of what they're doing from a sustainable perspective. And I think we have a genuine opportunity to build a brand that resonates with a large number of people by making products of higher quality that improve their lives, but also do something sort of beneficial towards the planet. And it just feels like a great way to spend my time until I die. If you're going to spend your time doing something, try and enjoy it and do something you believe in. And And I can hand on heart say, I truly believe in what we're doing and why we're doing it, and you know, how we're doing it. Well, you know, we probably do it better, but we're trying.
Fabulous. Well, that's all we've got time for. But Mark, a huge thank you for coming in and joining us. And as always, you know, we love the podcasts, which are a genuine conversation. If you'd like to join the conversation, please leave a comment or questions in the comments section below, or email us at info@future-plus.co.uk. And please remember to hit the subscribe button for future episodes. If you'd like to find out more about Future Plus or Sori, please visit the links in the description below. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Cheers.